My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have not found it necessary to have a drink, nor have I, since January 25th, 1981. I'm grateful for that, and grateful I'm here tonight. It's a privilege to be here. It always is good for me to be at an AA meeting. It's a privilege to be able to, when you're asked to speak at an AA meeting, I want to congratulate all the celebrants, and that was great. It's a great lead-in for... I couldn't help but notice how many of them were thanking God. And I couldn't help but notice how many of them were thanking God and said before they came here they would have never done that. It's an interesting deal. I heard a story once. It says as iron sharpens iron, man sharpens man. And I heard it said a different way by a celebrity one day. He said, the man or woman you'll be in the next 5 years will depend on the people you hang out with and the books you read. And without any question, the books I read and I read depend upon who I hang out with. And if you're an alcoholic like me, you're very much sensitive to peer pressure. You know, I'm such a chameleon. I mean, I'll tell you what, if I was in a country and western bar, I'm drinking beer. And if I'm in Key West, I'm drinking margaritas or whatever those funny drinks are down there. And if I'm in New York, I'm drinking Manhattans or martinis or something. I never get them mixed up. I never go to a country and western bar and say, give me a whiskey sour, you know, or something like that. If they're smoking marijuana, I'm smoking marijuana. If they're using cocaine, I'm using cocaine. I'm going to be doing whatever the crowd is doing to sort of blend in. And so because of that, even though I'd like to think, alcoholics like to think of themselves as leaders, but the truth of the matter is most alcoholics, and I have to admit, including myself, we're mostly followers. Yeah, you know, we're the ones that sort of looking around and see what everyone else is doing so we can sort of join in and blend in. You know, we sort of walk into that big bar with all those people there and, you know, sort of like in the back of our minds, we don't really even realize it's sort of subconscious, sort of measuring our inside with their outsides. They always look so much better and easier than we feel on the inside. And, you know, is the group going to like us and going to accept? I don't know about you, but I'd have a few drinks and I felt like I owned the freaking group, you know? And that's what alcohol did for me. It's not what it does to you, it's what it does for you. And that's what I used to tell my sponsor. I said, you know, I love people. I love, you know, it says in the promises, fear people will leave you. Fear people will leave you. I says, I love people. I used to live drinking bars. He says, well, if you love people so much, why'd you always have to be drunk when you're around them? Why'd you always have to have a few drinks in order to have sex or dance with a girl or, you know, or do anything? I love fishing. Why were you always drunk when you were fishing? I love playing golf. Why'd you always have to drink when you're playing golf? I mean, everything I did was basically an accoutrement to drinking. You know, and the truth of the matter is what I find out, by the way, if you're keeping track and there's no use doing that, I guess this is supposed to be about the second step. Now, one of the things that sort of bothered me, one of the things I do is I get up here, there's really not much planning, as you can probably tell, and one of the things that happens is it's sort of like Pulp Fiction. You know, I mean, I start in the middle, I go to the end, I'm all over the place, I forget what I was, you know, I'll get off the expressway onto some exit somewhere, I'll never come back, and so we had a good time last week on step one, or whatever that thing is I did. You know, if you have a group with a couple hundred people like this, I have no idea how many people this place is packed, but you know, what happens if you have 200 or 300 people in the room, or 2,000 or 3,000, whatever it is, there's 2,000 or 3,000 meetings going on. You know, everybody's hearing what they're supposed to hear, you know, and some guy hears the first step and some guy hears the 10th step and some, you know, it's really what's going on inside of you, not so much what I'm saying, and that's the bottom line. So one of the things that happens to me sometimes is I start going and I'll start with some story or something like that and then I get off on some tangent and this thing, I never come back again. So I usually need a bookmark, somebody who's actually paying attention. So when I get off the expressway, let me see, I don't know that somebody... Well, I got Eric, you'll be my bookmark, just in case. I was saying, you got to pay attention. So I have to say, where was I, you know? So last week, I told about a guy named, happened to occur to me as I was driving home. I was talking about a guy I sponsored named Tommy. Do you remember that? Was that for me? Okay. I was talking about a guy named Tommy. I don't know how many people were here last week, but that I sponsored. And Tommy was a guy, Second Step talks about... coming to believe that a power greater than yourself can restore you to sanity or insanity, you know, which sort of like assumes that you're like insane. And Tommy was a guy, when I was a prosecutor in the state, I met him when I was a division chief in the state attorney's office, and And he was a division chief too. And we used to prosecute murders together and stuff like that and all that. Do that sort of keen, sort of, you know, heady stuff for young alcoholics, you know, when we were, I guess I was between the ages of 20, you know, I don't know, 24, 25, 26, 27, something like that. I mean, I'm looking at this group. I mean, I felt old before I came here. Now I feel ancient. I feel like they found me in a dig somewhere. And you guys look great. And so, Tommy, when I was your age, 40 years ago, whenever that was, you know, and really 40 years ago, when I was your age, I was, besides drinking, I was prosecuting cases in the state attorney's office. As a matter of fact, I think I prosecuted about 20 murder cases before I was 30 years old, and which is, you know, pretty neat. We were having a good time, and Tommy and I were became like best friends. I guess what I'm trying to say is we became real good drinking buddies, and we had some good times together, and I happened to wander into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 31, and he was always he was a little older than me. And Tommy wandered into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous about after I had about 3 years sobriety. And Tommy, he came to Alcoholics Anonymous. He called me up one day. You remember I told this story last week, but I'm going to tell you the end of the story, which I didn't tell you the end, which has to do a little bit with the second step. And he's still sober today, by the way. I was his first sponsor, and he's got probably around 30 years today. And Tommy called me up one day, and I guess after I came into AA, we stopped sort of hanging out together because I was the kind of guy, I would call up Tommy. I just got here faster. I would call up Tommy on a Wednesday and say, I'd say, Tommy, we went to a bar which I helped name called the Alibi Lounge, you know, and that was my bar. You know, if you're an alcoholic like me, if you're a bar drinker, you actually own the bar. They don't know it, but you own it, you know what I mean? You call it like my bar. Like if you walk into the bar and they've changed the seating arrangement, you know, you get pissed off because they didn't consult you, you know? And you know, you walk in and you got like 50 or 100 bucks in your pocket and you say, well, this is going to be a good night. And then the bartender comes up and he says, you still owe 100 bucks from last week or something like that. And you can't argue with them because you don't know. You have no idea, you know? And you don't want them to cut you. I mean, you'll argue with anybody. Cops are, you just won't argue with bartenders because you don't want them to cut you off, you know? And, you know, they got that deal. So Tommy called me up, and I had about 3 years sobriety, and I was working in my office, and I was in private practice at the time. And he called me up, and he sounded desperate over the phone. He said, "I'm supposed to be in court, you know, and before a particular judge that we both knew." And he says, "I can't make it. I'm all screwed up." And you know, he was into alcohol and coke and all that sort of stuff. And I said, he says, "I feel like killing myself. I got a gun here. All this sort of stuff that Alky's saying." Depressed, I said, "Look, let me." He says, "I'm coming over," and I went. I called up the judge. I got that straightened out, and then I ran over to see him. And he was living. He had been living on the floor, sleeping on the floor of a probation officer's apartment that we knew. He had no clothes. He had like one pair of pants that hadn't been washed in about a week. He had like one shirt. You know, he had hair. This is a guy who was like one of these Ivy League guys. He looked like a jock, you know, and he was a jock. And when I saw him, he had hair down to here. He had a beard down to here. He looked horrible. And not that there's anything wrong with having a beard or long hair, but I mean, he just was unkempt. He was not looking good. He looked like he was out on the street. And this guy was one of the top prosecutors in the office. You know, I mean, TV trials and the whole bit. And he was a drinker and he was a drugger. And so I took him to his first, we got in the car, I took him to his first AA meeting. And he walked in. He's like one of the, he's sort of like me. The same thing that happened to me. He sort of walked into AA, and he sat down. He sort of like, it was like instant coffee. He thought he was like home. He was saying, "Man, this is it. I'm here. He was hopeless. I was hopeless. You know, my sponsor used to say, don't rob an alcoholic of his desperation. Every alcoholic has to drink his last drink. And you don't need much to get in here. Desperation is all you need. And I was desperate, and Tommy was desperate too. And he immediately took this thing. He started going to 1, 2, 3 meetings a day, and he was going to steal, and he got sober. Stopped drinking. Never has had a drink after that. And started doing this deal. And in any event, and so I was sponsoring him, and he was always, you know, he was excited about being sober. The next day, his hair was cut, you know what I mean? His beard was shaved. We got him pants. We got him a shirt. He looked like the old Tommy again. It was like unbelievable how resilient, how they, you know, bounce back. Of course, we were both maybe in our 30s or something like that, you know, And he was looking great, and all of a sudden, about I don't know, about a month later, a month or two down the road, I get a call from Tommy. And he was riding his car, he was somewhere, I'm not sure where he was, he may have been on the West Coast or something. He sounded sort of panicky. He sounded kind of sort of scared and anxious and panicky. And I said, Tommy? He says, yeah. I said, what's wrong? He says, I don't know, Russ. He says, I'm really bummed out. I'm really anxious. You know? He says, what? He says, I think I have to leave AA. And I knew he loved AA. He knew it. I said, you got to leave AA. He says, yeah. He says, I don't know. He says, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. I said, you don't think I'm an alcoholic? He says, no, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. And I said, well, why, Tom? He says, Russell, he says, I think I might just be crazy. And I said to him this, I said, Tommy, he says, what? He says, you can be both. He said, really? I said, absolutely, you know, absolutely. He says, oh man, thank God. You see, he had reached that point in his sobriety where he was beginning to suffer from something called alcoholism, which you really don't suffer from when you're drinking. You know, you don't suffer from alcoholism, you suffer from something called drunk. You know what I mean? You get drunk. You see, drunk is what you do to avoid alcoholism, you know? Now listen, I'm talking after 33 years of sobriety. I'm talking about after going through a lot of trials and tribulations. I mean, my sobriety's been road tested and stuff like that. I'm talking with living, you know, some of you guys have lived with physical sobriety for a month, some of you for 10 years, some of you for 15 years, some of you for 30 years. You've gone through what you have to go through. You've gone through the vagaries of life. You've gone through the boredom. You've gone through the thrill of victory, the agony of defeat. You've gone through the whole day. You've gone through what you've gone through, and you've gotten to some point somewhere where you've said to yourself, now I know why I freaking drank. Man, you know, now I know why I drank. This is crap. You know, I mean, I know we have a saying in here that says, what is the saying? Our best day, our worst day. What is that saying? My worst day, my best day, my worst day sober is better than my best day drunk. Hey, yeah. Listen, no. That's a lie. That shit you say to newcomers and you hope they believe it and they won't drink. Fear, if you think fear is bad drinking, fear is 10 times worse at 3 o'clock in the morning when you're sober. Yeah. Fear is horrible. I drank to get rid of what they thought about me. I drank to stop worrying about the boss. I drank to stop thinking about the crap I thought about. I mean, my thoughts, I always had to have a TV on, a radio on, something going on, some sort of distraction, because my thoughts were bad thoughts about myself and other people, and it bothered me. I couldn't stand, you know, that pregnant moment of silence. There always had to be a conversation going on. Because if you're an alcoholic, what you ultimately learn is that alcoholics, like it says in the big book, are men and women who drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. They're restless. They're irritable. They're discontented. I mean, you can lay a whole bunch of words on that. They are bored. They're pissed off. They are anxious. They are feeling sorry for themselves. They're full of self-pity. They're selfish. They're selfish. They have self, what is it? Selfishness. That is the root of our selfishness, self-centeredness. That's the root of our problems, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking. We step on the toes of others and they retaliate seemingly without provocation. But in the past, we realized that we made decisions based upon self, which puts us in a position to be hurt. So an alcoholic is an individual, is an extreme example of self-will run riot. Self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we must get rid of self. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. God makes that. I mean, that's the real problem. I mean, you can get rid of the drinking. How do you get rid of the bloody thinking? How do you get rid of the self? How do you get rid of me having a girlfriend named Lynn at the University of Miami, who I was hanging out with every single day? True alky love. You know, true alky love. Well, I like you. True alky love, well, you know, the world, the outside world refers to it as stalking, but, you know. You know. Sure, you're laughing, you don't know what it's like, but you know where you can murder, you can do anything to anybody, but it doesn't matter because you're in love. Because what alcoholics worship is their feelings. I mean, it's like the thing I talked last week about the milk. I come home and there's my wife, and she goes, and I've had a long day, and I'm walking, she said, and I have a little child, two kids or three kids, and my wife says, we're out of milk, you know, and I go, we don't have milk, we're out of milk, and I'm saying, you know, why? We're out of milk, we're out of milk, we're out of milk. You know what I mean? Why doesn't she, why, it's always, What's the matter? Were your arms broken? You can't get the milk? And why does she say, why does she just say, would you please get the milk? Why does we have to pull this, you're out of milk crap, you know what I mean? I don't think we have milk crap. I mean, I know what is that, some sort of woman thing? That it's like some sort of manipulation, you know what I mean? Hey, honey, we're out of milk. Why, you can't say, would you get milk? We're out of milk. You know, I suppose you want me to get the milk, right? You've been sitting here all day, you can't get milk. I've been working all day, putting money on the table, you can't go to the farm store and get freaking milk, you know what I mean? And he says, and so maybe I slam the door, I go out, maybe I get the damn milk, you know what I mean? Is it too much to ask that she gets the damn milk? I mean, I'm tired. And then I go and I get the milk and I throw the milk in the refrigerator and says, what's the wrong? We have a fight and the cops come and I tell them about the freaking milk, you know what I mean? And they don't understand, and they don't understand my feelings, you know what I mean? Because I'm sensitive, you know, and I'm so right, and, you know, nobody understands my problems, and because it's all about my feelings. It's all about me. It's all about me and Lynn Benson, who every day I stayed with, every day, and then finally on Christmas, she looks at me after being with our entire year, and she came from New Jersey, you know, which is probably half the crowd here, you know, and she said, my parents, who had been subsidizing her entire life down there, would like me to come home for Christmas. And without skipping a beat, without a nanosecond, like that, like an H-bomb went off in my mind. And I looked at her with such hatred. And I said this, well, what about me? Well, what about me? This one, what about me? What am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do at Christmas time? And you know, what about me? Me, me. And you want to know something with me? The truth is, if I could only get out of my body and see myself, it's always about me. My thoughts are always about me and what about me and how is this going to affect me and what's going to happen to me and what do you think? You know, the whole thing, you know, enough about me. You know, let's talk about you. What do you think about me? You know, I mean, it's all about me. And you know, when you think like that, and let me tell you something, you know how I think? I think like that sober. And when you think like that sober, you live in a world of fear. And when you're scared what people think and what's going to happen, you've got to control. You've got to control everything. You've got to figure out what's going to happen and how it's going to happen. And you've got to get control. You're going to hurt people and you're going to feel crappy. And you sit around and you tell yourself a million times you don't give a shit what people think about you as you're thinking all the time what other people are thinking about you. As a matter of fact, you really tell yourself real hard you don't give a shit what other people are thinking about you when you're really involved in worrying about what other people think about you. You'll sometimes even say it out loud, well, I don't give a crap what they think about me. But you ultimately learn that people that really don't give a shit what other people think about them don't say things like, I don't give a shit what people think about me. They say things like, pass the ketchup, or I'll take some London broil, or something like that. They don't say that stuff. And the great thing about alcohol is because I could drink alcohol and it would get me to a place where I really didn't give a shit what other people thought about me. I was free. Alcohol is the best thing if you've got alcoholism, which is probably why they call it alcoholism. I don't know. Now you see, you know, women, you know, sex will work for a moment or two. You know, money will work a little bit. Promotions will work, titles will work. New blouse, a new suit will work. Losing 50 pounds will work. You know what I mean? A promotion at work will work. There's a lot of things that'll work, you know what I mean? But I haven't ever found anything in my life that worked quite as well on alcoholism, on my form of alcoholism, which affects me most when I'm sober. Believe me, you may have need an excuse to drink. You know, the only reason I drank because I was awake. Awake was good enough for me. And the bottom line is that when you have what I have, nothing worked quite as well as just a few drinks. And I defy anybody to drink alcohol and have it do for them what it did for me and stop. You just ain't going to do it. It worked that well. And the problem with my deal is that it reached a point in time where alcohol stopped working. It stopped working for me. I started hurting myself and a lot of people. And the real problem in my life is it stopped working for me about three to 10 years before I realized it stopped working for me. And by the time it stopped working for me and I really realized it stopped working for me, I couldn't stop drinking. I was drinking against my will. That's when you get up in the morning and you say to yourself, I'm not going to drink today, and by 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you're drinking. And you get up the next morning, you say, I'm not going to buy booze today, and by 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you're buying, you're searching for nine sickles and quarters so you can get up enough money to buy a quart bottle of Carlos Rossi Chianti and sit by the phonograph. At that time, we had LP records, and listening to the same cut of the same record over and over again, like, you know, A Pirate Looks at 40, or Running on Empty, or I'm Mr. Blue, or Only the Lonely, or Rainy Days and Mondays, or some Karen Carpenter crap or, you know, whatever it is, you know? And you spend your whole life and your life becomes a bottle. And finally, you just give up at 31 years old. You say, you know, you can't envision a life without drinking. You can't envision a life without drinking. And you can't envision continuing the drinking. You can't envision stopping drinking. And then one day, and I lost my wife. I didn't lose him. I gave him away. Kicked me to the curb. She came home one day. She said, you know, one day I was going out to work, you know. You know, I was, let me tell you something. My brain was working better than it's working now. You know what I mean? I mean, man, my brain is shot. By the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, believe me, when I was 31, I had two neurons working. They were waving goodbye to each other. You know, I mean, back then, you know, around 26, 25, I had a wife, beautiful kid, house on LaGorse Country Club in Miami Beach. Going to my work, I'm 100 pounds lighter. I'm about to get in my car to go prosecute some case or something. My wife comes up to me and says, I just want you to know, you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. I get in my car, I'm more sober than I am right now, physically. I drive 3 blocks down the road, I say to myself, what the hell does she mean by that? You know, sober, what the hell does she mean by that? I'm doing high level litigation, I can't figure out what that means. Because when you're an alcoholic, one of the old ideas, unless and until an alcoholic accepts his alcoholism and all its consequences, his sobriety will be precarious and true happiness will find none at all. And one of the consequences of being sober is there's a whole lot of shit in life you just don't see. You don't really see reality. You don't see a lot. I mean, the first step in getting out of jail is you got to know you're in jail in the first place. You see certain parts of reality. You see certain material things, certain things in reality that are very clear to you. But there's a whole spectrum of what's going on around you, a spiritual spectrum that you don't even contemplate. Because it's hard to see what's really going on with people, places, and things when all you do is thinking about yourself. When your entire life is about you and thinking about you and worrying about you and thinking about how things are going to affect you, you probably miss about, I don't know, about what? 95% of the shit that's going on around you, including how you're affecting people and how people feel. Man, I'll tell you something. You are real cognizant of your feelings. Oh, man, if there's anything, you're so cognizant of your feelings, there ain't room for any other human being on the face of the earth except maybe a flipping puppy. That's about it. No other human being, because it's all about you. And that was me. And I didn't know that. I thought I was a good guy. And so I come in here, and so, you know, Tommy had reached that point where he had 2 or 3 months sobriety. And it was great being sober. He got initial, man, I'm sober. All of a sudden, I got money in my pocket. I feel better. I'm looking better. I'm not drinking anymore. And all of a sudden, the day came where he started thinking. He started thinking again. And, you know, with thinking comes worry and anxiety and all that sort of stuff. The crap that, the crap that he drank over. The insanity. You know, here's the deal. I was, before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was 3 o'clock in the morning on Christmas Day. And I had been kicked out of a Noche Buena in Miami. I think I talked about this last week. A Noche Buena in Miami because I had gotten drunk and I embarrassed myself and the gal's father said, get rid of this guy. And I got kicked out of that and I went home. So it was 3 o'clock in the morning. Apparently my plan hadn't been working. I planned after I got divorced and got rid of my wife and my child and my house and everything that was important to me. I planned on becoming the Hugh Hefner of Miami. And it didn't quite work out, you know. And so here I was alone in my bachelor pad in Coral Gables, Florida, at 3 o'clock in the morning on Christmas morning alone. And on the screen of the TV was some preacher preaching, you know. And, you know, preachers do what they do. They're selling the gospel. They're talking about Jesus. They're talking about a transformed life. They're talking about changing. They're talking about their testimony. I was like this. And then I was like, Amazing Grace. You know, I once was lost and now I'm found. Did all that stuff. I can't remember exactly what he said, but all I knew is I was desperate. I was willing to do anything. And by the end of his preaching, whatever he was saying, it struck a chord in me. I've always been a sucker for, you know, listen, I hate preachers. I hate being preached at, you know what I mean? But I love testimony. I love listening to stories. You know, in the Bible, which the big book was basically based on, you know, if you ever read Dr. Bob the Good Old Timers, which was written between 1930, you know, it says, our big book says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. That, by the way, the operative word there is thoroughly. Thoroughly followed our path. And that book was written in 1939. In other words, you do what we did, you'll get what you got. That book was written and published in 1939. AA started in 1935. Between 1935 and 1939, their path had nothing to do with reading the big book. They were reading the Holy Bible. As a matter of fact, the books that they found absolutely essential was 1 Corinthians 13, the book of James, and Sermon on the Mount. So most of this book came from those books and the study of those books. And so I was sitting there and I'm listening to this stuff. And finally, in the middle of everything, I get down on my knees and I gave my life to Jesus, which is not a big thing if you're Christian, but for a Jewish kid from New York, it's a pretty big deal. But you'd be surprised if you're desperate what you'll do. You'll be surprised if you're desperate what you'll do. And I thought for many years that nothing had happened there because I continued to drink. I just went to sleep and I continued to drink. You know, but something happened. Something happened because I'll tell you, I had been ripping, raping, and robbing for 31 years of my life, and I had never done that. If you had asked me the week before what I needed, I would have said I needed my wife back, or I needed a girlfriend back, or I needed money back, or I needed a new job, or I needed to move to Milwaukee, or I would have told you all the things that were wrong in my life because I don't have a drinking problem. I drink because I have problems. I mean, I know to you it looks like I have a drinking problem, but trust me, I drink because I have problems. You know, as a matter of fact, my drinking perfectly matches my problems. And pretty soon my problems are going to go away and I'm not going to drink so much. So thank you for your advice, but why don't you go screw yourself? You know what I mean? I had it all worked out because I was a rationalizer. I told myself rational lies. I can tell myself stuff. Believe me, nobody believes me more than me because I'm so brilliant. You know what I mean? I'm just like a brilliant drunk, which is why I wound up on the balls of my ass. You know what I mean? And you got to understand, every decision I made, I never made a decision where I didn't think it was the perfect decision that would perfectly propel me to stardom at the time I made the decision. So how did I wind up? And I was brilliant. And I got degrees to show how brilliant I am. So how did I wind up so screwed up? You know why? Because when all you're doing is thinking about you, your judgment is impaired. And so the bottom line is I finally got to the point where but the one thing I had never done, ever done, was get on my knees and ask God for help. Ever in my life, never. And that night I did. And 30 days later, after getting into a terrible car accident where I was drunk and almost killed myself and somebody else, I looked up at the ceiling when I was least able to do it and I said, God help me. And something happened. I can't explain it. I'm not going to explain it now at this place, but something happened. And a few days later, somebody came to see me, you know, gave me a 12-step deal and took me to my first AA meeting where I picked up a white chip. Never had to pick up another white chip after that. Now, I'll tell you why I'm saying this. One of the reasons I'm saying this at this meeting. I want to read you something from the book. I read this book. I asked some guy to be my sponsor. He said, okay. He said, here's what I want you to do. I want you to join a group, a home group. And, man, I'll tell you, I got to tell you something. I had a lot of old ideas. You know, alkies have a lot of old ideas that lead them astray, which cause them to do exact opposite of what they're supposed to do. And there's so many stories I could tell you, like parables and stories, that show my old ideas how they were completely wrong. I went out, he said, I want you to join a home group. He said, I want you to read the big book. I want you to every morning get down on your knees, read the 24-hour book and ask God's help to stay sober. And quite frankly, I don't remember him asking me whether I believe in God. He just said, that's what I want you to do. But you know, in my state, I was so vulnerable. You know, I was scared. You'd be surprised at the crap you'll do if you don't want to drink again. The one thing I had going for me, the only thing I had going for me is I was so scared of drinking, I was ready to go do anything. I'm just lucky the Krishna's didn't get a hold of me because I'd be down at the airport with a tambourine, you know what I mean? I was ready, you know what I mean? I was ready, okay? And he says, and the other thing he says, if you're going to have a drink or you want to have a drink, call me. He says, don't call me afterwards. He was clear. He says, don't even bother calling me afterwards. I don't really want to hear that you drank. You call me before you drink, okay? I go to the South Dade room to see. I said, what home group do you belong to? He said, you wouldn't like mine. You know, he says, no, you didn't want it. So I go down to the South Dade group. I walk in the room, I sit in the back there, you know, waiting for him to recognize, you know, the emperor of AA, that I'm the smartest guy in the room, that I have the answers to everybody's problem. They're going around the room, they don't even call on me. They're sitting in their little stupid cliques, you know what I mean? They're three or four guys at the table, you know, high-fiving themselves, like they all know each other. Not one son of a bitch comes up to me. Not one guy comes up to the newcomer. Yeah, love and tolerance is our call bullshit, you know what I mean? I can tell right away that they're bullshit, the world is bullshit, this AA thing is bullshit, it's a bunch of crap. I can see with all my own eyes. I mean, it was clear, it was provable. They didn't care about me, they didn't even ask me to talk, they didn't call on me, you know, they didn't care about me, nobody came up to me. Just a little clicks in their little groups. I went up to my sponsor, he said, how'd you like the South Dade room? I said, it's a bunch of bullshit. And he said, they're all assholes. He said, yeah, they got the little clicks. I went in there, I sat down, nobody came up to me. Nobody said hi to me, nobody gave a crap about me. You know, and I'll tell you something. In my perception, that's exactly the way it was. He says, I ain't going back there. He says, they're a bunch of crap. This is a bunch of crap. So he says, this is what I want you to do. I said, what? He says, I want you to go back there and I want you to join one of the cliques. I said, what? He says, I want you to go back there. I want you to join one of the cliques. I said, what are you kidding? He says, I want you to go back there and join one of the cliques. You pick one out and you join. So when you're new and you're scared of drinking and your sponsor tells you to do that and you don't have any fight in you because you know you're no longer self-willed and right because for a nanosecond in your life you got some humility where you actually do what you're told, because I would have never done it if I was like 6 months sober and I started thinking, you know what I mean? So I did it. And I went up and I picked the click and I said, hi, my name's Russell. He says, I'm new. And they said, you are? He says, sit down. So he sat down and they started talking to me. He says, hey, why don't you do the meeting? I said, me? I only got like, you know, 3 weeks. He said, that's okay, you can do the meeting. So I did the meeting. You know, after me was done, they all patted me on the back. He says, man, keep coming back. That was great. I walked out of the room. I went to see my sponsor. He said, how'd you like you? He says, it's a great group. I said, it must have been a whole new crowd. They really liked me. I had a good time. You know, you see, and that's the sickness. That's alcoholism. You don't know what's alcoholism. You think the world changed, or the group changed, or the stars changed, and it only had to do with following somebody else's direction from their brain instead of believing your own perceptions, which to you are so right and so clear. And so here's the deal. So I'm reading the 24-hour book every morning and asking God's help to stay sober. I got down on my knees and gave my life to God, you know, before. I'm saying the Lord's Prayer, you know. I'm starting to believe this stuff is maybe possible because I'm not drinking. I'm reading this book because he wanted me to read this book, and this is what this book is saying. Let me tell you what this book is saying. It's saying crazy stuff. It's saying there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. It says, see to it your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. Listen to what it says. It says, perhaps there is a better way. Let me ask you something. Anybody here ever have any anxiety? I mean, you know, you ever worry about money? You ever worry about what people think about you? You ever go to sleep worrying about something, you wake up and you're still worrying about the same thing? You ever worry about the same thing or the same situation or the same problem more than 3 or 4 days? You ever get to the point where, like, you know, you're a week and you're worrying about the same crap, what's going to happen to you about a particular subject, and you can't even talk to anybody about it because you know they won't understand? Or even when you do talk to somebody about it, it doesn't seem to help, it gets worse. You know, you ever have anxiety? You ever have, you know, that kind of stuff going on? You know? Let me ask something. How much of your day do you think has to do with feeling sorry? You know, whether you want to call it feeling sorry for yourself or worrying about what's going to happen. How much of your day is filled with worry or anxiety or fear? You know, that's sober, right? That's the way it is sober. And you maybe sometimes you say to yourself, now I know why I drink. Maybe that's why you're saying the serenity prayer all the time. You go to a meeting and for, you know, about an hour, you watch a dancing monkey like me or something like that, or some sort of entertainment, or you go to a movie or something, and for a nanosecond, you're diverted from what's going on in your life and you feel a little bit better, you know what I'm saying? Or maybe you have sex, you feel a little bit better, or maybe you buy a blouse and you feel a little bit better, you know, you do what I did, you spend money on money you don't have on shit you don't need to impress people you don't like, or whatever you do, you run around and you divert your attention and you do a million things and you get active just so you don't have to think. And you know what happens every once in a while? You stop doing that stuff, or you run out of things to do, and you're back to thinking again about that crappy deal, that crappy situation, and you're feeling crappy again, and you don't even know what the answer is. So you go to a doctor and you tell him what your story is, and he doesn't know anything about spirituality. He says, why don't you suck on one of these? He gives you some stuff to chew on. He says, so I can deal with somebody who I can understand what the hell their problem really is, who has a real problem. And you start sucking on that Xanax or whatever the heck you're taking in order to try to make that go away. You're chewing your booze or whatever it is, like, you know, that's the deal. That's what it's like when you're an alcoholic. So, now let me ask them, what do you think life would be like? I want you to imagine this. I want you to imagine life. We're going to just go for about 5 more minutes. Imagine what life would be like if you didn't have any of those thoughts. You know, the big book says, we have experienced much of heaven. We've been rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence, of which we did not even dream. And I think they're talking about something more than just not drinking. I know a lot of guys who are not drinking and they're thumb-sucking crybabies. I know a lot of guys that have not been had a drink in 15, 20 years, and you go up to them and say, how are things going? And they say, hanging in there, one day at a time. You know what I mean? Well, I didn't kill myself today. I never drink, you know? I didn't drink today. You know, it's like doing jail time, you know? Just one more day, you know, of bullshit, you know? Putting up with the crap. I mean, you know, really, I mean, come on. You know, I mean, what would it be like for you if you could live life? And I'm not saying it ever gets perfect. Nobody ever gets perfect. Even the six steps says we street. But you know, there's a big difference between having bad thoughts about yourself and other people and worrying about stuff every 5 minutes of every day. You know what I mean? And having it happen maybe once a week for 3 minutes. There's a big difference in that deal. What would your life be like if all your negative thoughts about yourself and other people just vanished and you never had them again? And you weren't restless, and you weren't irritable. And you know, drinking was out of the question. Hunting around for crap that you can't even afford. Hunting around for a woman or a man or a relationship or something like that you had to have because you need this and you need that and you need a meeting and you need this because you need that because by yourself you're a piece of crap and you don't got anything going for yourself. Where you're constantly on the hunt for some sort of fix. If it's not alcohol, it's going to be food. It's going to be something else. Something else is going to fill that vacuum. What would it be like for you if you didn't need any of that stuff in order to be okay? What would your life be like? You probably know that new freedom. Well, you know, here's the deal. It says perhaps there is, this is the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It says perhaps there is a better way. We think so. If we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. Hey, this ain't me talking. This is my opinion. I'm not expressing, now it is my opinion because after 33 years, you know what's happened to me? It's not that I've come to believe in the big book. I've become the big book. I mean, you do this thing for 33 years or 31 years, you find yourself living this thing, thinking this way, because you know why? After trial and error and going through the sleepless nights and all the crap, you finally come to the opinion that this stuff works and you start doing it all the time. Because you get sick and tired of feeling sick and tired. And you don't argue with the crap anymore, you just do it. And the next thing you know, you're just living your life that way. And it's not something you got to read in a book or some exercise you're doing, you're just doing it. And sometimes you stop doing it, you take a little exit, and then you feel crappy and you get slapped around and say, why did I stop doing that? Perhaps there is a better way. We think so, for we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role He assigns, just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us. And humbly rely on Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is a way of weakness. Paradoxically, is a way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be at once. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. How would you like to outgrow fear? At once. You know, all along the big book, it's consistent. Whether you even get to the part where it says, burn this into the minds of other people, job or no job, wife or no wife, let no man say he has his family back, all you need is a relationship with God. The entire book, from top to bottom, it says, you can't manage your way out of this, no human power is going to get your way out of it, no girl, no man, no husband, no wife, no job. God could and would if He was sought. The whole book is entirely clear. It has to do with one thing, focusing on God, realizing there is a God, turn your life over to God, have a new basis about God. And then once you get the 11th step, improving on that constantly through prayer and meditation on Him, and then carrying that message. That's what the whole book is about. You can do the steps till the cows come home. You can go to 15,000 treatment centers. You don't get that. You don't got nothing. They got one book to the non-believers, one chapter to the non-believers. You know what it's called? Chapter to the agnostics. You know what it says? I'll boil it down for you. It says, this sort of thinking has to be abandoned. Get over it. I mean, listen, this is gospel, so I'm not bullshitting. You got to read this book. That's what it says. Now, here's the real crazy part. That's the deal. You know, I don't even have time to tell you what happens as a result of that. Every once in a while, you meet something, you'll see what happens as the result of that. Okay? Here's the crazy deal. Here we are in Well People's Anonymous. And you can either do what the book says, or what they did between 35 and 39, or you can... go along with the wisdom, what I call the wisdom of the rooms. Now, you know, what are the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is made up of? Ready for this? Alcoholics. Who, by the way, the book says alcoholics are very sick people. It says we're defiant, okay? We're dishonest, untrustworthy, willful, and selfish. You know, well, you guys know what I'm talking about, right? That's what's in the room of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know something? Some of them have 30 years and they're well, and some of them have 30 years and they're nuts. And some of them have 2 years, and we're just an amalgam of craziness, okay? All, and you want something? Most of us are here trying to figure out how to do this thing without doing it. Sort of changing without having to change much. Sort of hanging on to our old ideas by doing this a little, you know, seeing whether that'll satisfy the son of a bitch, you know what I mean? While we're still worrying about what the other person is going to think about us. You understand what I'm saying? So the book says, if you want to be rocked in the fourth dimension of existence, experience much of heaven, you got to do these things we're talking about thoroughly. You got to be painstaking. You got to utterly turn your life over to God. And the wisdom of the room says, take what you like and leave the rest. Take what makes you feel good and leave the rest. And the problem is what makes you feel good keeps you sicker. And it's the rest that you don't like, which is going to rocket you in the fourth dimension of existence. That's the problem. And so a guy comes up to me about 10 years ago, new guy. I'm walking out of the car room and he says, are you Russell? I said, yeah. He says, you know, my sponsor says you're a good speaker and I ought to listen to you sometime. He says, but you talk too much about God. I got down on my knees. I gave my life to God. My sponsor told me to pray to God. In the rooms, all I'm doing is holding hands and talking about God. Everything I see in the book, it says there is one who has all power. That one is God. It says, see to a relationship with him is right and great events will come to pass through you and countless others. You know, it says if you sincerely take such a position, all sorts of remarkable things happen. Being all powerful will give you everything you need. You stay close to him and do his work well. He says, God is doing for you, but you can't do it for yourself. That's the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I do step series. I talk about the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I talk about God. Bill Wilson, the book Alcoholics Anonymous, in Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, says the following. This is what he said in Alcoholics Anonymous number 3. It's incredible. I'm just going to read this, and then we're going to finish it up. Then we're done. This is what he said to the man on the bed. He said, this is what I'll just read. It says, it would be hard to estimate how much AA has done for me. I really wanted the program and I wanted to go along with it. I noticed that others seemed to have such a release of happiness as something I thought a person ought to have. I was trying to find the answer. I knew there was even more, something I hadn't got. I remember one day, a week or two after, I come out of the hospital. Bill Wilson was at my house talking to my wife and me. We were eating lunch and I was listening and trying to find out why they had this release that they seemed to have. Bill looked across at my wife and said to her this, Henrietta, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease that I just want to keep talking about it and telling other people. I think I have the answer. Bill was very, very grateful that he had been released from this terrible thing and he had given God the credit for having done it. And he's so grateful about it, he wants to tell other people about it. That sentence, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease that I just want to keep telling people about it, has been a sort of golden text for the AA program and for me. I mean, you got to make a choice. It's either going to be God or mammon. It's either going to be, hey, you're either going to be chasing after him in this deal, or you're going to be chasing after the stuff you were chasing before you came in here. The cars, the broads, the guys, the gals, the sex, you know, the vanity stuff. Losing weight, getting this, getting buff, whatever the deal is. And there's nothing wrong with money or any of that stuff, as long as you don't put it before the real deal. And that's what this is real about, going after the genuine article. And yet this guy, and yet, notwithstanding what the book says, and notwithstanding what my experience is, and notwithstanding what I know, this kid comes up to me and says, my sponsor says you talk too much about God. You know where he got that from? A guy in AA. The rooms of AA, where people get nervous. If you talk too much about the only thing that's important. That's what you need to understand in here. That's why some people will have 4, 5, 10, 15 years and go out. And some people have 20 years and never find true happiness. And some people never make it. And it's the difference between them and true emotional sobriety, which Bill Wilson said was the next frontier. You know, that's the difference between them. You know, when they talk about the sixth step, the separation between the men and boys, that's between them. It's the difference between people who are totally focused on the deal that they're talking about in this book and the other people that are scared to be focused on it. They don't even realize they're scared to be focused on it. They're scared to make the commitment, okay? Because you know why? Because they don't want what we have. They want what they used to have back again. They want what the world has. They want what's on the billboards. They want what's in the movie theater. They want what Justin Bieber has. They want the Ferrari. They want all that. They're staring at all that stuff, which the world, by the way, when you get out there, if you think the world is trying to help you do this stuff, you're sadly mistaken. The rest of the world is chasing after the same crap that got you in here, and they're promoting it to you with millions of dollars, with guys who go to school who try to figure out how to tell you that if you don't have a hard-on for 4 years, for 4 hours, you know what I mean? And you're 60 years old, you're a loser, you know what I mean? They're trying to tell you that crap that's going to kill you is going to make you okay, and you believe that crap. You understand what I'm saying? That's what the world is doing to you out there, and you are defenseless. You are defenseless until you somehow, some way, develop some sort of faith that that stuff is wrong and it's a lie and this stuff is the real deal. And the only thing I know about the second step is somehow, some way, sometimes quickly and sometimes slowly, it started dawning on me what was true and what was false. And in my mind, I think it had to do with who I was hanging around. I really believe that it had to do with the people I hung out with. If you hang around with men and women who are into this stuff, you'll slowly start talking and thinking like they do. And if you're the one, by the way, you're the ones who make the decision who you're going to listen to, what books you're going to read, and who you're going to hang out with. You're the guys who are going to be sitting there saying, oh, the guy's full of crap, you know, and go out there and smoke and joke in the parking lot and talk about what you're going to do next weekend. You know, you're the guys who are going to make that decision. And the decision as to who you hang out with and what you do and what you think is going to affect you 10 years from now. 10 years from now, 20 years from now, when you're alone and you're on your fourth divorce and looking for your fifth wife or whatever it is, and the deal's going on and you're broke or busted or whatever it is, and you're trying to figure out why you are the way you are, you just remember, maybe you'll remember this talk. You'll remember this deal and what you thought about it afterwards. So God bless you. Thank you very much.
Guys, very nice way of closing.